It's sobering to think that at this moment there are places just an aircraft flight away from London where to do what we're doing now, getting together for open Christian worship and proclamation, is literally a life-threatening activity. Being a Christian in Britain today is no more life-threatening than being a Rotarian or a vegetarian. Yes, we may at times be ostracized, we're regularly patronized, but we're not imprisoned or executed in some back street, as some believers are elsewhere in the world. When we talk today of martyrs, we're not talking of people who lived and died hundreds of years ago. We're talking about people who died last week, last month, last year. In Iran, three top evangelical leaders were murdered in 1994. Pastors are interrogated and detained by police. Converts from Islam face imprisonment and torture. Execution is the official penalty for apostasy. Pakistan, in the past year, at least five Christian people have died while in police custody. In the southern Sudan, women and children are routinely sold into slavery, and there are reports of Christian people being crucified in some of the remote rural areas. And I could add to that list atrocities from Chile, from Egypt, from Cuba, from the Philippines, from Thailand, from Algeria, from Kuwait, from North Korea, and even from Saudi Arabia. Although there are something like 1.7 billion people nominally or actually Christian in the world, we are religious minorities in 87 countries, and Christians there are under pressure. The facts are that they are in many places being harassed, arrested, interrogated, fined, imprisoned, and even killed because of their religious beliefs, including sharing or spreading the faith. That's the world we live in, and some of it's going on less than a day's flight from where we sit. You know, there are people even in this congregation who have had to flee family and country for fear of their lives. Within the last fortnight, a relative of one of our own missionaries was held without charge by police in his country. And nationalism complicates the issue. We all know about powerful Islamization and the drive that that is in many countries. But it's not just Islam. In Thailand, Sri Lanka, Mongolia, a nationalistic Buddhism seeks a monopoly on citizenship. And even in India, a nominally secular country, the BJP party argues the notion that to be Indian is to be Hindu. The root meaning of martyr is witness. And the word was first used of the early Christians who under duress chose death rather than deny the lordship of Christ. You see, saying Caesar is Lord for most people was not a big issue. It was just words. It was over in seconds. It didn't need to represent heart belief. And yet, somehow it was a big issue if you were used to saying and believing Jesus is Lord. Because there can only be one Lord. And the stories of those early martyrs are moving enough. But you know, for me, the contemporary stories of people my own age are profoundly challenging. To be a martyr, you have to believe that something matters more than life. And with the death toll of Christian people rising across the world, we need to gain some understanding of that principle. We need to ask ourselves profound questions about that remarkable point of intersection between faith and death. Why do they do it? In a century of indifference and drift, how do you account for such single-mindedness? In a culture where suffering is so unfashionable, how do you explain being willing to accept death for the sake of Jesus Christ? Well, Daniel 3 gives us some help with some of these issues, because it's about believers under pressure. It's about how loyalty to the state can come into conflict with Christian belief. It's about how far we go. As we thought 2 or 3 weeks ago, it's about where we draw the line. It's not in this case about Islamization. It's about Babylonization. We know that this story inspired the early Christians, for there are pictures of the men in the fiery furnace in the catacombs at Rome. If you have problems with the miraculous generally, you will have problems with this story, just like the story of Jonah, or the walking on the water, or the raising of the dead. Is this fact or fiction? Is the writer a prophet or a novelist? Well, the biblical record makes it clear time after time that at times God breaks into history and nature in what C.S. Lewis calls miracles of the new creation, designed to manifest his power and reassure his people. And this, I believe, is one of those instances. But you know, the central point of the story is not the miraculous deliverance, because we know from contemporary experience and the witness of Christian history that that doesn't always happen. The breathtaking thing in this instance is the God-centered confidence of these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In this story, faith is more important than fire. And that's why we've called this sermon Defiant Faith. Look at the core of it in verses 17 and 18. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it and will rescue us from your hand, O King. But even if he does not, or as the RSV puts it, but if not, we want you to know, O King, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Surely one of the great faith statements of the Old Testament. It's one that we need to get hold of. Total faith in God's ability. Total acceptance of God's decision. That's faith. That's defiant faith. That's dynamic faith. That's martyr faith. Because martyrs are the but if not of believers. This is hardly sort of name it and claim it stuff, is it? You expect a miracle, yes, but you're ready to serve God without one. You recognize that God is God, but that he may still choose in his sovereign love to let us fry. That's defiant faith. Well, let's look at the background to the chapter briefly. First of all, verses 1 to 7. I've called that the anatomy of totalitarianism. It's probably about 15 or 20 years since the forgotten dream of chapter 2, which we thought about last week. And Nebuchadnezzar, probably now the most powerful man of his time, is in the process of consolidating the most powerful empire on earth. Religion and culture are, as we know, powerful cement in skilled hands, and they can be used to forge political loyalty and national pride. And that's exactly what he's about. And these plans need a sort of millennial-type project to focus the minds and hearts of the people, and they find it in the massive gold-coated tower or obelisk of verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 90 feet high and 9 feet wide and set it on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Was it a statue of him? Was it an image of his patron god, Nabu, from whom he took his name? Well, we don't know and we're not told. It probably hinted at both. Its purpose was to focus attention and pride and to sort of somehow harness religious zeal and cultural diversity around one king, one empire, and one official faith. It's launched at a sort of glittering festival of Babylon, to which, verse 2, the great and the good are invited in force. And the plurality of national instruments, verse 5, and musical styles sends a welcome signal that there is room for cultural flexibility. It's an all-embracing, all-welcoming show. Everyone's got a part. Anything goes, up to a point. Verse 6. Because this ultimately is not an arrangement that tolerates debate or dissent. Why, everyone will want to bow down to support this image, to honor it, to worship it. Why wouldn't anyone want to do that? It's in the interests of the state, it's in the interests of harmony, it's in the interests of peace, it's in the interests of national and cultural cohesion. Well, why not bow down in front of it? This is totalitarianism. It's totalitarianism, and it's been its way throughout history. Listen to this from a German youth leader in 1936. One cannot be, he writes, a good German and at the same time deny God. But an avowal of faith in the eternal Germany is an avowal of faith in the eternal God. Whoever serves Adolf Hitler the Führer serves Germany, and whoever serves Germany serves God. Well, substitute Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, and I suspect you've got something of the atmosphere of Daniel chapter 3, the anatomy of totalitarianism. Then secondly, in verses 8 to 15, what I've called the inevitability of opposition. The choice of verse 6 was simple. Conform or die. Bow or burn. It was as stark as that. Anybody trying to live an authentic Christian life will sooner or later come into conflict with the world. And the sooner we realize that, the better. It's inevitable. Because, you see, the world has always hated nonconformity. It is perplexed and irritated by those who will not bow down to the things to which the world bows down. It hates absolutes in a world of relatives. It tolerates everything except the intolerant claim that Jesus is the only Lord who requires our submission and our allegiance. And when the crunch comes, as it did for these three, it's often completely unexpected. Because, you see, these three were no sort of martyrdom hunters. These weren't people who were keen for confrontation with their state or their leaders. No, these were conscientious senior civil servants getting on with the job, living life normally, faithfully, and quietly. And all of a sudden, they find their world falling apart. They'd already taken a stand. We saw that in chapter 1. They'd drawn the line, as Rico so helpfully put it a few weeks ago. They had done it over a small but insignificant issue, the food issue in chapter 1. But this is the big one, and it overtakes them quite unexpectedly. You see, their Babylonian government service had gone on. There hadn't been any further compromise. They'd been able to get on with life. But the message of this to me is that no believer can ever afford to relax. Because frankly, we don't know when the crisis is going to come. And when we find ourselves on the ropes. Because things change. Things change in states, in countries. Things change in workplaces. Things change in families frighteningly quickly, and we can find our backs against the wall. Stand up at work for some inconvenient point about honesty or integrity, and suddenly your boss says you're not performing quite as well as you were, and maybe the time has come to move on. Tell your parents you're having to make some changes as a result of Christian lifestyle, and suddenly there's a sort of icy coolness that creeps into what you thought was a pretty solid relationship. Informers, verse 8, are not just a feature of 20th century totalitarianism. They're nothing new. They'll often be a colleague, a business associate, a family member, a social acquaintance, somebody ready to denounce you to somebody else if self-interest requires it. And as if the external pressures are not bad enough, there's also the internal pressure, for this sort of thing is frightening, it's awkward, it's embarrassing. Families, jobs, careers, homes, even lives can be at risk. How easy it would have been for these three to compromise or to rationalize. How often we do it ourselves, we keep quiet, we look down, we put on a bland, uneasy smile, we justify our carelessness as tolerance or flexibility. After all, they weren't being called on explicitly to deny Yahweh, just to acknowledge the new cultural and religious arrangements. That was all. Just a few words, one bow, and it would all have been over and the matter could have been closed. But they refuse. And they leave Nebuchadnezzar, verse 13, furious with rage. The inevitability of opposition. It can come suddenly and unexpectedly. The next section, verses 16 to 18, I've called the tenacity of faith. Back to these glorious verses, because these really are the heart of the passage. To Nebuchadnezzar's sarcastic question of the end of verse 15, "What God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" These men know that there is an answer. Verse 17, "The God we serve. He is able, he can do it." Why? Because he's the God of the Exodus, of Sinai, of the conquest. He's the God of creation and the God of history. This situation is not beyond him any more than any other situation that any Christian person can ever face. He can deliver a miracle, of course. But you know, what to my mind is so arresting about these verses are those three words in verse 18, "but if not." That's to my mind what makes this passage special. You see, these three men fully expected a miracle. The point is they were willing to serve God without one. Their attitude was like Job's. Job 13, 15, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him." You see, they don't see death, even death, as the ultimate disaster. It's like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German pastor in Flossenbürg camp in 1945, awaiting execution, who wrote, "We still love life, but I do not think that death can take us by surprise now. It is we ourselves and not outward circumstances who make death what it can be, a death freely and voluntarily accepted. I must be able to know for certain that I am in God's hands, not men's. Then everything becomes easy, even the severest privation." And as on the 9th of April 1945, he was led out to the gallows, a fellow British captive recorded his parting words, "This is the end. For me, the beginning of life. Well, you know, that's authentic faith. That's tenacious faith. That's martyr faith. That's but-if-not faith. The conviction in the very depth of our personalities that to live is Christ and to die is gain. Well, we need faith like this more than ever today, don't we? Faith that knows that God can and does intervene. Faith that, yes, prays with expectancy, but also faith that trusts so much in God's goodness that it can never dictate or demand, and faith that doesn't collapse when the answer is no. You see, the same God who said yes to Jesus in healing the blind and raising the dead said no to him in the garden about evading the way of suffering. And the great encouragement of those verses that we read earlier in the service from Hebrews 11 is that whether you're among the some who pulled through with the help of miracles or whether you're among the others who were killed, all are commended for their faith. Well, what about us? Very few of us, happily, are in life-threatening situations, but we all face faith-compromising pressures in everyday life. And the question is, are we but if not believers? Because here's the mark of defiant faith. Are we able to say, Lord, I believe you are able to protect me and my family from all danger, illness, accident, death, but even if not, I will not bow down to serve the gods of bitterness. Are we able to say, I believe you are able to preserve my reputation and my career if I take a stand for what I believe to be right, if I come out clearly and decisively as a Christian at work? But even if not, even if I lose all that, I will not bow down and serve the gods of cowardice or go the way of the world. Are we able to say, Lord, I believe you're able to open the door into that job, that ministry, that country, that opportunity which seems so right to me? But even if not, I will not bow down to serve the gods of anxiety or despair. Are we able to say, Lord, I believe you are able to help me find a life partner to enjoy your gifts of marriage and children? But even if not, I will not bow down and serve the gods of self-pity. But if not faith. Not so much great faith, but faith in a great God. So strong, so attractive, so necessary, and yet at times so hard. The anatomy of totalitarianism, the inevitability of opposition, the tenacity of faith, well, I've just got a moment for a fourth heading, the companionship of the Lord, verse 25. There's a surprise here. There's a fourth man in the flames. As these believers are cast, so it seemed, to an agonizing death, in the superheated furnace, they're joined by an unmistakably divine figure. Now, whether it's an angel, or whether it's an appearance of the pre-incarnate Christ, we will only ever know for sure in eternity. But what matters is that God is in the crisis. With all its horror, he's there beside them. It's a very simple picture, but an enormously beautiful and reassuring picture. And if this is Christ in his pre-incarnate form, what a glorious privilege for these Old Testament believers. Fellowship with the second person of the Trinity, 6 centuries before his birth as a man, and all because they valued truth more than life itself.
See, however alone a Christian may feel in suffering, they are never truly alone. The Lord is there. The Lord is there. He's with us in whatever hardship. He's sovereign. He's in control. Well, we need to know that for hard times. What a beautiful illustration it is of Isaiah's promise in chapter 43, verse 2. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the waters, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze, for I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. Or Paul's confidence at the end of Romans 8, that nothing in all creation can separate us from the love of Christ. Well, these are truths we know well, but they're truths we need to stockpile again and again and again for the hard times. In a moment we come to remember the most significant death in history. If you're ever tempted to think that suffering or sacrifice are pointless or meaningless, reflect on this death. The very opposite is true. It's the way in for each one of us to eternal life. And since that first Easter, we now say with joyful confidence, death, where is your victory? Death, where is your sting? That's martyr faith. That's but if not faith. That truth alone has steadied the nerves of Christian people for two millennia. John Chrysostom was one of the greatest of the Greek fathers. He lived in the 4th century and became Bishop of Constantinople. As a young Christian, he was brought before the emperor and told that if he would not give up Christ, he would be banished from the country. And Chrysostom said, "You cannot, for the whole world belongs to my father." And the emperor then said to him that he would take away his property. And Chrysostom replied, "You cannot, because my treasures are in heaven." And then the emperor said, "I will take you to a place where there is no friend to speak to." And Chrysostom replied, "You cannot, for I have a friend who is closer than a brother. I have Jesus Christ forever." And the emperor finally threatened, "Then I'll take away your life." And the answer was, "You cannot, because my life is hidden with Christ in God." And the emperor said in exasperation, "What do you do with a man like that?" Well, it's a good question. It's the question posed by the witness of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's the question that our lives should be posing in the modern world every day.